All rise. The Supreme Court for the State of Nevada is now in session. The Honorable Justice Pickering presiding.
Please be seated, everyone. This is the time set for argument in Burke Construction versus District Court 90665. Are counsel ready to proceed? Thank you. You may.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Susanna Santana, and I represent Burke Construction Group, Inc., and I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, if that works. And we are before the Court today as the District Court has adopted, as a matter of first impression, an equity exception to employer immunity to common law liability under Nevada Industrial Insurance Act, also known as the NIIA. And generally, under the Act, an employer is immune from common law liability as long as they provide workers' compensation insurance to their employees. And this applies both to direct claims from employee to employer and third-party claims of contribution and indemnity as well. And an employer's right to compensation under the workers' comp statute is their sole and exclusive remedy. And now the elements under which an employer would benefit for this common law, civil law exclusion is if four things are met. First, the employer has workers' comp insurance. Then the employees are covered under that policy, and we're also dealing with an injury that occurred while on the job during the course and scope of employment. And lastly, there's no independent duty that's owed from the employer to the third party. And all of those things were present here, which is why Burke filed a motion for summary judgment in the district court, which was denied. So what real parties in interest are asking the court to do is to not apply the exclusive remedy and to take away Burke's recognized immunity under the Nevada Industrial Insurance Act and consider an equity exception for the first time. And this equity exception would bring concurrent employer negligence before the jury while keeping Burke in the case. They do not want Burke to be dismissed. And the district court has agreed with real parties in interest position, which is why we're in front of the court today. Now, the real parties in interest main reliance or main support for their position is the Santa Steven case. However, it's our position that Santa Stevens doesn't say what real party in interest think it is saying. It doesn't adopt a broad equity exception, especially not under the comparative fault statute or the comparative fault framework in Nevada. Specifically, Santa Steven is a Ninth Circuit case, which is not binding for our purposes. Secondly, it's considered both in Outboard, which came after Santa Steven in 1977, and in Kellen, which came down in 1982. And all three of those cases dismissed the employer because there was no independent duty, so they considered employer dismissal proper. Now, Santa Steven, which I think is the portion of Santa Steven that tends to confuse parties, is the section where they talk about a burden shift, where a party is held responsible for more than their apportionment of fault. And specifically, Santa Steven actually talked about this, and they said, it's usually argued that the major cost of insulating the employer from liability is that it places a share of burden on the shoulders of the third party. However, that is not true of the Nevada statute as interpreted by the district court. In a portion of the decision not here appealed, the court held that the employer's tort recovery from third party would be reduced by the amount he received in workers' compensation benefits. And the court also said because
Ms. Santana, does it matter here that Ms. St. Amand did not pursue any workers' comp remedy?
It does not, Your Honor. And the reason being that the only thing that needs to be shown in order for an employer to benefit from immunity from liability is that they had workers' comp, that the employees were covered under the policy, that this was an on-the-job injury, and that there was no independent duty. And in terms of the independent duty, both real party in interest and the court in its undisputed facts section has said there's no independent duty. However, where there was a mistake made is that the court said there's no independent duty. However, I'm not going to give Burke the benefit of immunity, and you have to proceed in this litigation. And that's where we think things went sideways. And in terms of Santa Steven actually supports the position that the employer needs to be dismissed because there's no independent duty that's owed, and they don't qualify under any exception that would prevent them from benefiting from this remedy. And further, if we look at the history of when Santa Steven came down, and then when this state became a comparative fault state, and now we have several liability, Santa Steven first came down in the lower court in 1973. Then we have Santa Steven in 1974, and we have comparative fault. So once we have comparative fault, things change because the apportionment of liability depends on the amount of negligence of each party. It doesn't fall on the shoulders of just one party. And then we have the 1977 amendment to the Nevada Industrial Insurance Act. And under that legislative session, the legislature specifically looked at concurrent employer negligence in an offset situation or a reimbursement situation. And they said, we're not gonna consider concurrent employer negligence for the analysis. It's not relevant, it delays employee recovery, and we're not gonna consider it. And they specifically adopted language into the statute, NRS 616.215(2)(a), that said employee compensation would be reduced notwithstanding any act or omission of the employer or a person in the same employee which was a direct and proximate cause of the employee's injury. And now there were some amendments that were done in 2025. However,
so what is our test for determining whether there's an independent duty?
So there would need to be an express indemnity contract, or there would be a statutory duty to inform a public utility before repairs or work starts, and we are under neither one of those situations. And when you don't qualify under any of those situations, then there's no independent duty. And there's also additional exceptions to the exclusive remedy under case law, which we don't qualify under. And some examples are if this is a non-compensable injury under the Nevada Industrial Insurance Act. Another one is if we're dealing with an occupational disease, and then a third one is if an employer's conduct was intentional. We're under neither one of the situations. There's no grounds to preclude us from enjoying this immunity from litigation. And in further looking at the 1977 amendments, the legislature said, concurrent negligence is not a factor to be considered. And furthermore, Santa Stephen even said, the employer needs to be dismissed. There's no independent duty. And then when Kellen came down, and actually I'd like to backtrack and talk about Outboard first, because that came down in 1977 as well. And Outboard said, even if an employer's duties make them 75% liable and a third party plaintiff is only 25% liable, if there's no independent duty, there's immunity. And Outboard went further and said, in terms of inequity, just like real party in interest is bringing up, although this contention has some appeal, it is one to be submitted to the legislature rather than to us. The matter of indemnity should have never been submitted to the jury, and the third party complaint should have been dismissed. Then we have Kellen in 1982, and again they say, no independent duty, there's immunity for the employer, and they go even a step further. And they say, in terms of a duty to the public to exercise ordinary care to avoid other drivers, this is not an independent duty. When we're dealing with duties between employer and employee, that's exactly the type of thing that the Act seeks to extinguish and should be given immunity to the employer because of this. And one of the main issues that real party in interest alleges, it's equity. However, Nevada is a comparative fault state. There's several liability. And there's no inequity. In terms of their concern in Santa Stephen as to them bearing more of the burden than Berkwood, they're entitled to list a dismissed employer in the verdict form, and then the jury can do a proper apportionment. They wouldn't be dealing with any part of the negligence which isn't going to be attributed to them. So there's gonna be proper apportionment, and that was the main concern. And Outboard and Kellen, they both cite to Santa Stephen and say, okay, this is what Santa Stephen says. It's in line with our ruling, we dismiss the employer. And the court has found that in Nevada, an occasional harshness with this is characteristic of the statute itself, and it's not up to the courts to fashion a more equitable result. However, we say Santa Stephen doesn't adopt this equitable exception. It doesn't exist, and any inequity is resolved in comparative fault.
Could you address the propriety of extraordinary writ relief from an order that was entered after fairly significant discovery?
Yes,
a motion for summary judgment. I read in the briefs that you're set for trial, I guess it was April and now June this.
Currently, the motion for stay was granted, so everything was stayed down in the district court, so there's no formal trial date as of right now.
Okay, so that there's no trial date at this time?
Correct.
But what remains in discovery that would be avoided by us issuing an extraordinary writ?
So in terms of our issue, nothing. RPMK has been deposed. We've done all the discovery. That was actually one of the things that the court wanted us to do before ruling on the motion for summary judgment. They wanted us to do all the discovery that we needed to do in order for them to consider whether we're immune. So we filed actually a motion to dismiss as our first appearance, where we argued immunity. That was denied. Then we filed a motion for summary judgment in 2024. That was denied on the same grounds. We did a motion for reconsideration. That was denied. And the writ is what followed. So at this point, all the discovery that needs to be done for this relief to be granted, it has been done. There wouldn't be anything additional that would change in any way whatsoever the ability to grant this relief today.
So why is not an appeal, an eventual appeal, appropriate remedy that's adequate?
And it wouldn't be an appropriate remedy here, Your Honor. It's because we filed a dispositive motion on the exact same issue here today in front of the district court three times. And it was denied every time. And in terms of refiling, either even if we go all the way through jury trial, that was actually done in outboard, and they overturned the verdict because immunity should have been granted to the employer. And then in terms of Kellen, that was handled via writ. And still they said immunity should have been granted to the employer. So in terms of, it would act as giving us additional burden when the situation could be resolved through this relief here today. And if we were to refile the motion either in the pretrial stage or go through trial, it's not likely that we would be given proper relief.
Okay. But your point isn't that this is an issue that is dividing courts around the state or anything. You're saying essentially that this is settled law, that under Keller and outboard, the district court went off the rails and denied summary judgment, correct?
Correct, Your Honor. And we actually attached a series of district court orders where immunity was granted to the employer. And it's our experience that only in front of Judge Newberry was this motion denied. So even in terms of division, there is some division, at least in terms of this court, where they, like you said, went off the rails and didn't go in abidance with the law.
Okay. Thank you.
And at that point, Your Honor, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal, please.
Very well.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. Cindy Hernandez on behalf of respondents KYL Group and driver Sheng Shi. There is no dispute about what the applicable case law is. We have briefed and perhaps overbriefed the applicability or inapplicability of outboard as well as Kellen. There can't be any reasonable denial that both of those cases were founded upon the interpretation by the Ninth Circuit of Nevada's Industrial Insurance Act. So to argue today that the Ninth Circuit was off the rails is actually inappropriate. It was Santa Stephen that developed the jurisprudence that we're in dispute over today. But what's important, Your Honor, is to not only acknowledge that law, but acknowledge the relevant facts here. We're not asking on behalf of the respondents for a broad brush remedy here. It's actually a very nuanced issue that the legislature really can't touch. It's something within the jurisdiction before this court, and here's why. We have two employees from Burke Construction. We have the lead driver, Daniel Miller, who we've taken the position as the active tortfeasor. We have Ms. St. Amand in the middle, and we have my driver, Mr. Sheed, towards the back. There's no dispute that materials that should have been tied down according to Burke's policy weren't. They spilled into the roadway. Ms. St. Amand tried to avoid them, and she was hit from behind from Mr. Shi in a truck that just simply could not respond. Mr. Miller wasn't injured here, and he never made a workers' comp claim. Under Chapter 616C020, the statute specifically requires an injury in addition to the elements that Ms. Santana identified. So without an injury, it's very curious how Mr. Miller gets the benefit of absolute immunity or workers' comp immunity when it's not even triggered as to him. So that in and of itself would support the third party indemnity and contribution claim that's currently in dispute here. And frankly, Your Honor, I would submit, or your justices, I would submit, that's where the analysis really should stop. There's no reason to go on to the Santa Stephen exclusion. But because it's been briefed and it's important to the respondents, I would like to touch upon that, because what we're talking about here is fairness and what is just under the facts of our case. Mr. Miller acknowledged, as well as Burke's designated corporate representative in his 30B6 deposition, that there were violations of their safety policies. Mr. Miller had been with the company for some time. He was a direct supervisor for Ms. St. Amand, and she directly asked him, aren't we supposed to tie these down? And he said no, when he knew better. So they both proceeded in the face of harm with almost virtual certainty that harm would occur. And harm did in fact occur. Mr. Shi, in a much larger vehicle, certainly couldn't anticipate that materials would spill two cars ahead of him. And these were materials specifically selected by the Burke employees to set up in a construction trailer on a project offsite. So it's very important when we're talking about equity, if we were talking in a context outside of workers' comp, who's the active tortfeasor and who's the passive tortfeasor. And I believe that we've adequately identified who the passive tortfeasor is, Your Honor, and that's Mr. Shee, whereas Mr. Miller is the active tortfeasor. But I think it's become very salient through looking at the materials, and I think Ms. Santana did a fine job briefing at the district court level as well as here to identify some issues. But I also do think that there is some lack of clarity in the underlying order that I'd certainly like to bring to this court's attention, because I do think these are important considerations and in some part justify why this is an important issue of first impression and actually should be granted to extend what is appropriate case law nearly 60 years later. We've talked about whether or not this appeal really should go forward, because I think there's grounds outside of workers' comp to support the indemnity. But what's also was raised at the district court level, and still some lack of clarity here, is when do workers' compensation benefits really apply? Is it sufficient under our current legislature scheme that the procurement and proof of procurement is enough to be afforded absolute immunity? Especially when you consider that it didn't pay out anything more than perhaps a pro rata insurance premium to benefit Ms. St. Amand. She didn't make a claim. Mr. Miller didn't make a claim. He's the active tortfeasor, and I would argue perhaps she is too, because she had the decision not to proceed, and she did. She knew better, and she went forward with it anyway.
What statutory support do you have for the argument you're making?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear.
What statutory support do you have for the argument you're making?
As to Mr. Miller's...
No, what you're saying is that because she didn't make a claim under workers' comp, despite that she was covered, she should be allowed to proceed.
Well, that's what's missing in the legislature. Under Chapter 616C, she has a 90-day window to submit a claim. And so what the employer does is wait those 90 days, and then after those 90 days, if she doesn't submit a claim, then she's barred under the Industrial Act. I think there's an open question as to whether the lack of a claim precludes now for a lesser culpable party to take full freight from an event that was caused specifically by their employees while on the clock and during the course and scope.
My question is, where do you find that in Chapter 616?
There's not a specific provision to your point, but I still think that's a judicial discretionary issue. That's not an action for the legislature, because that's a nuanced evaluation when you're considering two employees in the context of four different chapters and encompasses the entire NIIA. So that is part of the clarity that we're seeking here, is what does it really take to be an initiation of the workers' comp statute? Is it just enough to have the insurance, or does a claim need to be submitted? Because this is not an insignificant case. We have claims from Ms. St. Amand, who's claiming that she's virtually blind now because of this accident. She is treated now over in excess of $1 million. We expect them to try and board $7 million. It is important to have the employer here, but what also came out in the briefing as I was preparing is this. When we talk about fairness, and whether it's just to just allow the third party tortfeasor, who's less culpable, to answer for all the transgressions that occurred in this case, it forces Ms. St. Amand to play the role of both the employee and the employer to justify what happened under what the respondents would call suspicious or perhaps inadequate safety policies that were outright rejected by its own employees. And I don't think it's appropriate to proceed in the absence of the employer, who never has to answer that question. All we're asking is that the employer remain in this case. And to your point, Your Honor, I want to make sure that the court really understands the posture of discovery. The only relief that was requested as it related to Burke was really twofold. We did standard written discovery that wasn't fully responded to, and we received leave on a 30B6 to take Mr. Travasso's deposition, which he provided some but not all safety policies. I didn't get additional policies until after his deposition closed, leaving me in the position to move for leave to get additional testimony. I haven't done that because this is what happened with the appeal. But I do think that there's some obscuring of the truth here, and the employer, Burke, is the one obscuring it, whether through the actions of Mr. Miller or on its own. We have briefed this issue, and I think it does come back around to what is just and fair under Santa Stephen. What Santa Stephen brings out, and I think the facts of this case...
Ms. Hernandez, how is this case different than Kellen, which apparently also involved an automobile accident?
Your Honor, I wish I could give you a more substantive answer other than the fact there are two paragraphs included in Kellen. It identifies the initial District of Nevada Santa Stephen case that talked about through the Honorable Judge Thompson. It appears that it was anchored in the subrogation case, and there was some credit afforded for the workers' comp lien. And I think the language is included there is to echo there's some amount of equity or acknowledgement that the third-party tortfeasor should get a credit in some respect for being a participant in the injury and damages, but it shouldn't pull full freight. So to answer your question, I don't think that there's enough of an evaluation in Killen to help answer that question. And Santa Stephen isn't really mentioned other than a drop footnote, and it's not the Santa Stephen that we've relied upon for purposes of our responsive brief.
But Santa Stephen is not binding on this court, right?
Well, I do think because it's interpreting the very act that's in dispute today, I absolutely do believe that it's binding. It's a Ninth Circuit case. It's still good law. That's how Outboard and Killen were developed. There's been no repudiation of that case. And especially, I don't believe that the language that we're relying upon that's included on the page of that opinion, that it,
so,
your indulgence, I can...
So you think that we are obligated to follow the Ninth Circuit interpretation of Nevada law on a non-federal constitutional issue?
To the extent that it is interpreting Nevada law, and there has been no further appellate practice in the Ninth Circuit to clarify anything in Outboard and Killen, then I do think you have to consider them as a trio here. Killen does not identify any real other than a broadstroke brush, doesn't really provide any analysis for this court to determine whether or not it squares with the relief requested or if it's the governing standard. I think that we've gone to great lengths to identify within the underlying briefing as well as our responsive brief that they don't square on our facts. There's just not enough information to do a meaningful analysis. But that's really where we're at here today, is that a comparative fault instruction is not enough. Some of the arguments that were raised before you today appear to be arguments that weren't raised in the underlying briefs. But if the test to come back around to whether or not there's an independent duty, I think that we have to now analyze this case in the context of what's going on with Mr. Miller.
Why is a comparative fault instruction insufficient?
Because it doesn't account for the employer's role in this accident. This is not merely an empty chair where the employer wouldn't go forward with... I'll just finish my thought. This is not a situation where an empty chair defense is sufficient for purposes of the respondent's position. There are important factors here. The damages are significant. Ms. St. Amant continues to treat. We continue to get records. We've got 35 treating providers. We haven't gotten to the point of expert reports. And so to come back around to something that was said is, what is this idea about additional costs? We're moving into expert discovery, and my clients have absorbed 100% of those costs. We have absorbed all of the costs. What I think on facts really do earnestly show that KYL and Mr. Shi were the passive tortfeasors here. The only participation that the employers brought to the table today is this motion practice. And I had to fight for the 30B6 when it was objected to. I've had to do follow-ups on my written discovery. When it comes to a point, if this is such a clear issue, then I think the district court absolutely would have, on the motion to dismiss, on a Rule 12 motion, jumped this case to the curb. And that's just not what's happened here. And I think that's because we didn't get one over with the trial court. I think it's a meaningful opportunity and a good faith argument to expand existing law. And that's what we've brought to the court today.
But counsel, we have an obligation to follow the law that exists, not the law we want to exist. So I'm having a little bit of trouble squaring this with the statutes that we have. and frankly, the case law that we have that exists in Nevada from the Nevada Supreme Court.
And I think that's a fair question. In looking at the petitioner's authority under advanced countertop, one of the questions that came up in that case is, can a workers' comp recipient or employee still continue on with a common law indemnity claim, even though you receive partial benefits but not final benefits? And in that instance, outside of all of these exceptions that were brought to the court, the Supreme Court said yes, absolutely, because there hasn't been a final judgment there. How you square that with the existing statutes, and I've identified in our brief that there are opportunities within an active and open workers' comp claim for the employee to pursue other alternative remedies against the employer in the context of the Industrial Insurance Act. We, on behalf of the respondents, continue to believe that there is no legislative act that is required here to deliver the relief that's requested. Your Honor, when oral argument started, you raised the question, and I was going to do it on my time to argue, is the writ is just inappropriate here. We have done a lot of discovery on this issue, to Ms. Santana's point. There's really nothing left to do to brief on this. And the real issue that remains are the related damages that Ms. St. Amon has put on this case. That may even require us to reopen her deposition. Her deposition, I think, was taken over 2 years ago when we didn't know all of this treatment. As her employer, who really didn't participate in her deposition, it puts the respondents, and what I continue to believe the less culpable parties, is to pull full freight, and that's just not what I believe is appropriate, even under existing NII statutes. The problem that, in the worst case scenario here, is this. When there is no workers' comp claim open and no benefits paid to Ms. St. Amand and none paid to Mr. Miller if he had an injury, is think about it. As the active tortfeasors, they can wait out the 90 days. There can be a conversation, say, just hold on and we'll go seek this against somebody who has more insurance. And the only skin in the game that the employer has is to maintain workers' comp insurance. I don't think that's an appropriate outcome here, and especially because the byproduct of that is, if we get in a situation that we're in right now before this court, is that the employee has to take on responsibilities to defend her employer's policies. And I don't think that's covered by the comparative fault instruction. I think that requires the employer to defend those policies and to either say it was a reasonable breach or it shouldn't be considered as it goes to standard of care. And I well recognize, and that's really why we're here today on a third-party practice, is that the petitioner enjoys the same defenses that I do in this case, but we're coming at them from different angles, and obviously right now, very opposite ends of those angles. So I do think that there is a middle ground, but that middle ground comes from a judicial determination. We don't need the legislature here, and it is an issue of first impression, because as much as I read chapters 616A through D, it doesn't square here, which is why, and I believe that it's appropriate to say here, as we see the development of equity come up in the form of equitable indemnity and other areas of jurisprudence where the statutes just don't square. And I do think that's exactly what we have here. So the respondents submit that existing statutes, based upon our facts, does not require this court grant the writ relief. The more reasonable substitute as a remedy is to find that equity does apply on our facts when it appears that if you're going to use workers' comp as a shield, or excuse me, as a sword, you can't really use it as a shield for somebody who doesn't even trigger the statute. And to come back to where I started, Mr. Miller's conduct is the act of tortfeasing. He's the active tortfeasor here, and that gets us outside of workers' compensation. Thank you, Your Honors, for your time.
Thank you very much. We have roughly five minutes and 48 seconds. Not roughly, exactly.
Thank you, Your Honor. In addressing some of the points that Ms. Hernandez has gone through, our case is just like Kellen. There is no independent duty, and there's no reason why Burke shouldn't benefit from the immunity. We don't qualify under an exception, and this is a sole and exclusive remedy to the employee. And Mr. Hernandez mentioned, what triggers this? Why are they immune? What triggers this is them having workers' comp insurance, them providing that benefit to these employees. And then how does any inequity get addressed with a comparative fault instruction? That's the framework that we are set under right now with NRS 616 and with the comparative fault framework in Nevada. And in terms of discovery, all discovery needed to grant this immunity has been done. There's been no meet and confer requested for documents not produced. There's been no motion to compel. Everything that's been asked, it's been disclosed. Moreover, like I said earlier, to get this immunity, we've done everything we need to do for this to be granted. And in terms of equity, the court has addressed this thoroughly in Outboard and in Kellen. Those cases came down in 1977 and 1982. And they have said, in terms of equity, this gets figured out in terms of proper apportionment. The employer doesn't need to be a part of the trial in order for this to happen. And there's been specific case law as well in D'Angelo that says a dismissed employer can be listed on the verdict form so the jury can do a proper apportionment. And in terms of Santa Stephen, as the court has recognized, this is a Ninth Circuit case. It's not binding. It doesn't work against me. It supports my position that employer should be dismissed, but it's not binding before this court. The binding cases are Auburn and Kellen. And if we want to look at legislative intent, we can clearly see that in 1977 when the court decided, when the legislature decided not to recognize concurrent employer negligence. And unless the court has any questions, Your Honor, based on that, Burke would like to respectfully request that judgment be rendered in its favor based on his motion for summary judgment on the lower court.
Thank you. I don't have any. Justice Bell, do you have any?
I do not.
Thank you. I want to thank both sides for their arguments and briefing. The matter will stand submitted, and we will be in recess until the further call of the court. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.